We need to have financially viable solutions that acknowledge the challenges people face and are sustainable in the longer term. We also need those actions to be taken at all levels and all parts of society, from individuals to businesses to governments, because that is what it will take for us to even start moving towards most of these targets.
Welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast, where we explore biodiversity conservation and the environment more broadly and interrogate conventional wisdom for the sake of a more robust case for conservation. I'm your host, Andre Mardo. Many conservation managers and scientists may not be aware that there is a single common set of global biodiversity targets that inform national conservation strategy in almost every country in the world. These 23 targets are the main part of the Kunming-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework, or GBF. The GBF was agreed on by parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity, the CBD, in late 2022, and the targets are meant to be achieved by 2030. This is a pretty monumental task, considering that the multi-year strategy that preceded the GBF, which concluded in 2020, unfortunately failed to fully achieve any of its targets. The GBF is also accompanied by a monitoring framework of indicators for countries to measure their success toward achieving the GBF's targets. That monitoring framework is still being compiled, and an ad hoc technical expert group has been tasked to guide its development and completion by late 2024. The GBF and its monitoring framework might seem distant and disconnected from on-the-ground conservation, but they can be hugely influential on prioritization of conservation worldwide. Conservationists of any kind would probably benefit from a better understanding of what's behind them and what's inside them. Alice Hughes is a conservation scientist, prolific author of peer-reviewed articles, and associate professor at the University of Hong Kong, who has recently published two peer-reviewed papers that analyze the GBF. She joins me to discuss the challenges behind the GBF and its monitoring framework, and she's open about her concerns over the setting and measuring of the GBF targets. We also explore how the GBF and its monitoring framework might be improved, or might have been improved. This is a somewhat technical discussion, but don't let that put you off. The basic premise is pretty straightforward, and if you check the webpage for the episode, you'll find links that explain all the different acronyms that are used. Alice covers a very wide variety of topics within her conservation and her research, so I began by asking why she decided to dedicate some of her time and focus to this particular issue.
I've got two papers on the GBF, one that came out in January, just trying to translate it so that it was accessible to scientists. And so they actually understood the process, because there is a major disengagement between the scientific community and what goes on in these multilateral discussions. I first attended a CBD meeting in Cancun in 2016 or something. And it was interesting to see that translation or lack of translation for me, but also the fact that there are not often many scientists in the room when these negotiations happen. Now, global conservation, global prioritization, all of these are being driven by, in many instances, these kinds of discussion. And so having good translation of scientific data and scientific knowledge is key if we're going to have appropriate targets, if we're going to have appropriate frameworks for monitoring them. And so that lack of dialogue and that lack of interaction is a major barrier. Now, for me as a conservation scientist, my role, as I see it, is I will describe myself often as someone who tries to understand patterns of biodiversity and drivers of biodiversity loss with an aim to inform more effective conservation. Now, of course, at a high-level meeting like that, we are looking at global targets. Now, those global targets only mean anything if they can translate at the national level. And so trying to be in those discussions, trying to fill in the knowledge gaps is critical. But what I've also seen now, within these kinds of meetings, you have, as you will be aware, the special groups. So you've got the NGOs and the IGOs and the IPLCs. The academic community will occasionally be what's known as a major group, but in most of them, it isn't. And there is also some contention around the last meeting when it was a major group, but it was partly because of business activity within it, which has seemed to have compromised things because they had a different set of objectives. Inclusion of academics within these meetings is growing, but they still don't quite know how to identify And also that integration of science is just one of many things that needs to be considered when these discussions are being had. And so something I have been trying to do is do that two-way translation so that scientists can understand more of what happens in these meetings and how we as a community can contribute better, which is critical, but also to try to provide the science back to those who are in the special group, the ARTEG, who are trying to actually refine things like the monitoring framework so it's functional. And so by trying to provide that two-way translation, hopefully we can bring those communities closer together, but we can also get more dialogue and interaction. And that is going to be critical, not just for the success of this set of global targets, but even more so for what follows it. Because something that I think, especially with COVID, was very evident was there's a lack of dialogue. Many of the targets, much of the monitoring framework is not really fit for purpose. But we have what we have. So what we should be doing is using it to the best of our ability, but also thinking about what we could have done better, because in 2030, we will be renegotiating a successor. It's only 7 years away. It's not long. That means for things like certain indicators, monitoring biodiversity, if we want to have new indicators, that work needs to start now. Because we need to be working with countries to show that it's effective, and we need to have countries on side if it's going to have any chance of actually featuring into a framework like this.
Right. So generally speaking, and I mean, I know from the paper that this discussion is more or less based on, that you are pretty critical of the GBF and constructively critical of the GBF in general. What are your overall critiques before getting into the targets in particular?
One broad thing is the fact that whilst we have a relatively limited glossary, we do not have a glossary of many major terms. This is consequential because it means that how those targets are interpreted is going to vary between different countries, different regions, and may provide major loopholes, meaning that rather than actually helping implement effective biodiversity, it can do the exact opposite. And I mean, a great example of this is something like the early renditions of the RED framework, where it drove deforestation, it drove monoculture, and we still see various iterations of this across parts of Asia. The problems of having loose, non-agreed-on terminology is there will be actors who use it to make profit and say, yeah, we've reforested this area, but actually it's just a eucalyptus plantation and it's not native. And so that fact that we still do not have agreed-on definitions is problematic. And in with that, especially for things like forest cover, the definitions that typically get used by all the UN conventions are the definitions that were created by the FAO. And they are purely based on forestry and profit. The same is true for sustainable. The term sustainable gets bandied around a lot, but without a definition, without specifications, without actually having criteria, you can define a target to be sustainable, but you have no way of measuring that. And this is also one of the shortcomings between what we have with the targets versus the monitoring framework. The monitoring framework often does not actually measure the targets explicitly, or it monitors parts of them, or it's not actually temporal enough to be able to monitor them at all. And so whilst there are many strong elements of the overall framework, there are also major gaps, and there are problems with enforceability, as well as some that you can look at the text and you're like, okay, this is the result of the fact that they had 900 sets of brackets, and this text doesn't actually totally make sense. I can see where they're coming from, but these compromises mean you have a much weaker target. Now, I think there are many ways we could tackle this and do it more efficiently, but we do also have to be clear about what we can do now. And so there is a specialist group, the ARTEG, that is looking at the monitoring framework, but their remit is very, very limited. And so we cannot monitor or many of the targets. And what we know from the Aichi targets is one of the major things that stopped us from reaching them was the fact we could not monitor them. We did not have milestones. And despite the fact we now have a monitoring framework, its ability to allow us to do that is also severely limited. So we had the Biodiversity Indicators Partnership that was meant to be designing indicators for the Aichi targets. And it basically did its thing. didn't have a whole lot of political supervision. Now, whilst having an agreed-on monitoring framework gives it more power in some ways, it also means it's become a whole lot more political. And that means that it doesn't have some of the flexibility that Biodiversity Indicators Partnership might have had to actually develop more optimal indicators. And so there are good and bad things about the fact we have that type of monitoring framework. And so we've created something that is much more complex, harder to monitor, and less good in many ways at monitoring, and is much more political, which means that it is much harder to change that structure. And that creates a set of real barriers when we only have 7 years to actually achieve many of these targets.
So I was going to get into the specific targets, but I think it's probably worth picking apart some of what you said there, which will probably overlap a bit with the targets discussion. But as far as the glossary is concerned, I mean, that's a pretty straightforward topic, I think. And one thing just to mention is that, well, maybe two things. One is that it amazes me that we don't have agreed upon definitions for many of these terms, because a lot of them have been around for a very long time. Others, like nature-based solutions, kind of new or resurfaced, you know, so they kind of, you can understand it there. But so that's an interesting thing to think about. But the other thing is that I note that IPBES, in their assessment reports, they have been including glossaries. And I know that IPBES and the CBD are quite, they're working together quite well, in some ways at least. Do you think that's going to help, you know, the fact that IPBES are sort of defining things? Of course, this is, you know, that doesn't mean the definitions are perfect, but do you think that's helpful?
I think it should be shown very explicitly to the CBD, because having core agreed upon definitions means you have something that is enforceable. And otherwise, the fact that you can pick and choose your definition really waters down the effectiveness of many of the targets. And so something like that, where you already have a multilateral body that is developing these definitions, if those then become part of a central repository, you don't have to really even dedicate much additional effort, because it's being done. But you have to say, these are the agreed upon definitions, and other definitions should not be referred to within the context of the framework. Something like that would really fix a huge number of issues. And I mean, you bring up the example of nature-based solutions there. Now, I've talked to the IUCN policy team about this, and they're like, oh, but we have a definition. We have a whole paper on nature-based solutions. And it's not that bad, but it's not referred to within the framework. So the fact you have that definition isn't actually that much more useful than me developing a definition, putting it on my laptop, because you can pick and choose. And so, yes, it's great that there is a definition out there and it overlaps with the ecosystem-based solutions. But unless it's referred to, then the fact that they have a definition is almost meaningless. And so we do need to better link these things together to save ourselves work and to also make things a whole lot more effective. The same is true for sustainable use. So sustainable gets used everywhere, and it's within two of the targets of the framework, so within multiple, but especially targets 5 and 9, which are about the sustainable use of biodiversity. Now, I pointed this out during the SUBSTA meeting when they were discussing sustainable trade of wildlife. And A, many of them focus on illegal trade, which of course, illegal trade is illegal. And so we shouldn't really need to have targets on something that is already illegal, because it's illegal. We need to have more tools to enforce them. But the legal trade in many species is often neglected, and people will even conflate legal and sustainable, which are not the same. Now, to measure sustainable trade, you need to know the levels of offtakes and you need to know the source population. There are no targets around that. And so the fact that you have two targets that are focused on sustainable wildlife trade, the only indicator is fish stocks, and the only other data you have, which is not actually noted within the monitoring framework, is CITES, which is for a subset of species. And so you have, in that instance, two targets completely unenforceable, because you do not have the basic data you need to actually do anything about them. And so it's a wish list, because if you have no mechanism to enforce it or measure it, you can't move towards it. During the SUBSTA meeting, I actually voiced this. Several countries came to me to talk to me afterwards, because they want to actually do better within their nations. And they haven't filled in these gaps, like better databasing what wildlife you are importing and exporting, because that data is vital if we're going to have any form of sustainable wildlife trade. but very few countries are doing it within agreed standards that allow you to quantitatively understand what's going in and out. Those are basic things and not in the framework.
I think anyone who's familiar with the GBF and its predecessor, the strategic plan and its IG biodiversity targets, will know how different they look to each other. You know, the IG targets are very short and sort of to the point. And there's slightly fewer of them, 20 versus 23. And then the GBF targets are, I mean, in one case, and target 19's case, almost a page long. And yeah, and you know, you and I before the chat were talking about the negotiation process. And I think in the paper you have some ideas about, you know, how these targets ended up being drafted the way that they were. And that had to do with you know, the fact that negotiations were delayed and were not in person for the most part until the ones at the end. Why do you think it ended up so much more complex than the Aichi biodiversity targets?
So it was a really interesting process. So I was there for the zero draft discussions, which got moved to Rome at the beginning of 2020. But at that point, a lot of people were saying we would be better off just keeping the Aichi targets because you have quantitative indicators that you can't measure with arbitrary percentage increases. And you have this, what they call theory of change. So you have the SMART targets that are meant to be specific, measurable, and ambitious, and realistic, and time-bound. Most of them don't satisfy this in the end, but this was an attempt to make them more achievable. And I mean, having that SMART approach is one reason they are more complex, because they wanted something that was specific enough to achieve and did have a timely component. But I think there are positives and negatives to that. The fact that they are more specific should make them easier to achieve, but in many cases you just have so many caveats. They're not always meaningful. Like, pollutants are harmful levels, we quote that in the paper. How are we defining harmful? There's also no proactive elements. And as you know, horizon scanning, so looking at what issues may be problematic, was pulled out of the framework. But that means even when we come to things like perverse incentives, there are targets on reducing what is there now. Nothing proactive about preventing that problem from recurring. And so you're not really fixing anything in those instances. And this is also slightly drifting from the point. Another major issue, because in being so specific, sometimes it actually made it also less dynamic and less adaptable. But also another reason that they are so complex is, as you know, we went into the meeting with 900 pairs of brackets, and every chair is different. Every set of negotiations are different. But when you have to hear 50 suggestions of alternate text, in some instances, it's because it aligns with national legislation and this word does mean something in a legal context for that country. And then you can see, okay, yeah, I understand that. In many instances, it's just, well, this is my preference, or I want to be seen to be heard. And so then you have to create a compromise text. And it's, I mean, it's like designing a horse by committee and getting a camel. You end up with so many bits you have to put together that you don't necessarily end up with the optimal output because you're trying to achieve agreement. Personally, I can think of better ways of negotiating a better text. And I think the way that the IUCN negotiates motions, even though that's not a UN process, but it would still actually work within this framework. So in every IUCN meeting, you have a series of motions that are put forward. Now, any member of the IUCN is able to draft a motion. It has to fit a very specific format. And then they have to get support from a number of other members. If they get sufficient support, it will then enter basically the online motion discussion. And then any member is free to make suggestions, and you have your moderator moderating it. If there is no contention and everyone agrees on text, then it will just be voted for during the IUCN meeting that we've agreed on it. And there are several rounds of this happening. If it is something that is more challenging and difficult, then it will go to the floor and you will have multiple working groups during the IUCN meeting, just focusing in on that issue. And then it will go back to the floor to be voted on. And so you have an approach where attention is given to those that are particularly difficult and those that are not contentious, you still have many eyes. And so you end up with text that is much stronger, but you still have countries voting on it. And so every UN convention is different. CBD, you need to have basically no objections, which is really hard to get good text through with no one objecting. Whereas others like CITES will have more of a consensus approach, and then you need to have a majority. And so if you need to have all parties agreeing on a set of texts, it's difficult to begin with. And your ability to address major points, especially important ones, is going to be compromised. And so having the ability to actually finesse the text more would probably end up with a much stronger text that would still meet the requirements of the CBD.
Just to bring us back to the monitoring framework, which is still being developed, actually. It'll only be finalized at the next COP, which is in about a year's time. And that's full of indicators, and there are different kinds of indicators or different sort of rankings of indicators. And you've basically indicated a few times that there's a mismatch, I guess you could say, between the indicators in the monitoring framework and the GBF, which it's supposed to service, basically. Can you just explain or sort of overview what that mismatch is, and also what the different indicators are, or the kinds of indicators rather?
So the monitoring framework is split into two major sets of different targets. One are the binary indicators, which are basically yes, no, we have done this, we haven't done this. Now, we don't focus much on this within the paper. They have a lot of disagreement because slight tweaks to the text. So it might be like, have you got a policy on climate? Or it could be, have you got a policy on climate that does this? And so slight changes to those binary indicators, which are still under a lot of work, could result in completely different results. And if you have a policy on climate, because there's no qualitative element, it wouldn't then tell you if it's actually doing what you want it to do, or if you're moving the right direction. The monitoring framework itself and the main component of it is split into three major sets of indicators: headline indicators, the component indicators, and the complementary indicators.
And sorry to jump in. So just to clarify, so those three levels of indicators, each of those could be binary or non-binary indicators.
Binary is kind of separate. And so it didn't even get discussed much, but they are being done at the same time. And not all parts of the GBF targets have binary indicators, but some of them do. And some of them will have both that and headline indicators. And so now we have an incredibly messy system where some countries might be like, well, we'll just do the binary indicators, because they may well end up being things like, do you have a policy on climate? Yeah, I'm doing great at these indicators that don't tell us anything qualitative. The main monitoring framework is more complex. So we have the headline indicators, which countries are all meant to do. And then we have complementary and component indicators. Now, those split it down. They are often much stronger. One reason that many of them were not selected was because they were seen as being more technical in many instances. And so countries are like, we don't have the resources or the expertise to do this. It requires too much. And so when we were having discussions in the monitoring framework room and saying, look, this is not that hard to actually monitor, some countries are like, yeah, we don't have the resources to do that. That seems to require too much expertise. And this is where it comes back to the fact that we need to be looking very carefully at the monitoring framework now and what indicators we need. Because for any new indicators to be approved for the 2030 Action Agenda will require countries to be on board. And that means there needs to be a good proof of concept in the fact it's workable, it's efficient, it isn't too expensive, and it's meaningful in advance. The headline indicators that were selected were things that basically countries had often heard of. But despite the fact all of the indicators were meant to be published somewhere or used somewhere, many of them aren't. And so sometimes you will see a headline indicator and it will have an asterisk saying, there's no methodology for this. And so part of the goal of the ARTEG, which is the ad hoc body of the scientific committee, is developing methodologies, which again seems slightly strange, because if there is no methodology, someone still has to have proposed it as an indicator. And if you've proposed something as an indicator, there's a realistic likelihood that you have the expertise to develop a methodology for that. And so it feels like a lot of energy is being wasted by reinventing a wheel that probably does already exist. But other headline indicators are things that are widely heard of, like the Red List of Species and the Red List of Ecosystems. Now, everyone's heard of the Red List of Species, and actually we just got a preprint out on some of the shortfalls in the Red List of Species. One of the reasons that it is not suitable as an indicator is these indicators are meant to be time-bound. Any IUCN Red List assessment on a species is only considered out of date when it's over 10 years old. And in some instances, you might just have the committee saying, is there any significant change? Okay, then we'll just put a new date on it and we have the same assessment going. It's hard to know how many species this has been the case for, but it means that for many species, even by the time we come to 2030, when this initial framework is meant to end, you may have at most one data point. You can't see if species are declining or increasing using the Red List of Species. It doesn't give you that information. It wasn't designed to give that information. And so whilst it is an easy, obvious indicator, it is not fit for the process of monitoring because it doesn't do that. Similarly, for the Red List of Ecosystems, which is another headline indicator, only a subset of systems have actually had any assessment. Those probably will not be reassessed. And the methodologies varied. So, for example, China did a Red List of its forest ecosystems. But if you actually look at the methods, they don't follow the guidance. And so those are two major ecosystem and species indicators, which do not provide you with any monitoring information. Another example, as I already mentioned, we have two targets on sustainable wildlife trade, 5 and 9. On target 5, the only indicator is fish stocks. It doesn't tell you if reptiles are declining because of pet trade or fashion trade. It doesn't monitor trade for most species. And at the moment, because the CBD gives the mandate to the ARTEG, that technical working group, they've said if it has a headline indicator, then yeah, it has a headline indicator. You don't need to see if there's a mismatch. And if it doesn't have a headline indicator, well, you're not meant to fill those gaps. And so where we have no indicator or an inappropriate indicator, we're not looking at it. The only real thing they are looking at the moment is developing methodologies for indicators that were proposed by somebody that don't have a methodology, which to me seems like a misuse of resources because it's not efficient, but it's also not addressing things that we are not currently monitoring, which means our ability to actually reach future targets is severely compromised.
I guess the idea behind the monitoring framework and especially the headline indicators is standardization, right? So the CBD provides the GBF and the monitoring framework behind it so that countries can kind of bring that down to the national level and so that all countries have the same template more or less that they're applying and so that they can be compared and, you know, progress can be, can have some kind of standard measure. But, you know, considering everything that you've said now and also just kind of thinking about the logical complexity between countries, you know, the how different contexts are, the sizes of countries and ecosystems and management capacities and so many other variables. Do you agree with the idea that countries should use headline indicators, even if they had comprehensive and good ones, you know, just theoretically speaking?
So it's a really good question. And as you know, it's very complicated. If we look at things like the State of the Planet reports, etc., and you get these big, scary figures like a 69% decrease in wildlife populations around the world, and then you go into the data and you're like, yeah, you used a whole lot of inconsistent methodologies and you can't draw those conclusions, the Living Planet report. We want to have consistent data. Obviously, to understand where we're losing biodiversity, having consistency and standardization is really important. But if your alternative is between good and meaningful indicators versus something that is not going to actually indicate it, you have a real challenge. Within countries, NBSAP, so National Biodiversity Strategic Action Plans, all of them are meant to be basically developing a set of strategies to maintain biodiversity. The reality is that within those targets, they will not be able to use most of the headline indicators. Some countries will have regional or national red list assessments, and in those instances, they might be able to, depending on how frequently they reassess them. And so that would be an example of where something that is semi-standardized can actually scale up, because you've got your national red list and you've got the global red list. But I think something that we should be doing within a monitoring framework is thinking about things that are scalable at a national level, that can provide a set of criteria and standards so they are meaningful at the level at which they are being monitored and can be acted upon, that have enough standardization in the methodology that they are comparable. But we do not actually really have that. Some of the headline indicators do allow us to do that, but many of them, especially those around species or sustainability, don't. And of course, we also have a challenge when you have something that is transnational, then you do need to have comparable data from multiple countries, like a species distribution across multiple ranges. So I think something we need a much bigger component on is giving standardized methodologies so that they can do it at the national level, but we also have data that is comparable. And at the moment, we kind of have the worst compromise of having data that doesn't scale that you're meant to be doing at the national level. I think having a core set of indicators to measure would be useful, because we do need the comparability, but then actually providing guidance on the framework for how you monitor this thing, be it harmful pollution levels. Like, how on earth we're going to measure that is beyond me, but countries will want to have guidance. And for that outcome to be standardized and meaningful, we need to have some kind of agreed on criteria. And so providing something that, okay, these are our headline indicators, but this is how you actually do them at national level that you can then act on, that is a step that we are currently basically completely lacking. And for some of them, like the red list of ecosystems, it's going to be the percentage of ecosystems assessed in all probability. But again, that doesn't tell you the health of those ecosystems or if it's changing over time. And so having measures that actually give us a qualitative element of how well or badly we're doing, rather than, yeah, well, we've done something, maybe.
And the sort of double danger there, or the built-in danger there, is that, you know, by reporting on an indicator, you're giving the impression that something's been done or something is known. And, you know, kind of like that box gets ticked some of the time, and then attention is taken away from that particular issue. I was going to ask you this much earlier, but just to go back to the targets, if you had to choose, or if you were able to redraft two or three of those targets, which do you think they would be, and why? And I also mentioned to you when we were emailing beforehand, well, I asked if you could include target three among those, even if it's not one of your selection, just because it's had so much attention. This is the one on the amount of land put aside as protected areas and other effective area-based conservation measures. So if you could include target three there, it would be great, but as well as one or two others.
I'd probably include most of the targets within goal A.
Which includes target three, right?
Yeah, five, three, one, two. All of those do need considerable work if they're going to be effective. Five is on sustainable wildlife trade, which I've touched on before. And so, again, the fact that we don't have definitions of sustainability, and we're also collecting none of the data we need in order to measure it, means, and I mean, the IPBES assessments stated this. Analysis we've done for the United States shows that they import about 30,000 or so species of animal, not including livestock. 30,000 species. We don't have any data on the impacts. How are we going to have sustainable wildlife trade when we're not monitoring populations and we're not monitoring volumes of trade? Now, part of that is easy to address. You can provide guidance so that you have standardized systems that even mirror elements of CITES that are just about databasing the amount of international trade. We now have four separate UN bodies that are working on this. We have CITES, we have to a degree the CBD, we have UNDOC and UNCTAD, which are looking at basically trade and international crime. They're all doing bits of this separately. And that means coordinating it is very challenging, but we're still not collecting the basic data we need in order to make sure it's effective. And one of the only reasons that it's even getting any traction for many species is the biosecurity risks of transporting diseases. And so often the only data we have is actually not being collected for anything to do with wildlife. It's about biosecurity. And so it doesn't provide the data we need to understand the impacts of trade. So that's a really big issue. And having two targets around it, because nine is also around wildlife trade, but a different element of it. Unless you have those core measures, you cannot make it effective. And we know for many species, this is the major threat to species survival. So it's not something that we can afford to neglect. Now, of course, targets 1, 2, and 3 are all about elements of conservation, protection, restoration. Some of them have garnered attention because of things like indigenous rights and indigenous communities, which are, of course, important. There's also the challenge of measuring those. So Target 3 in particular, about 30% protected areas in terrestrial areas, freshwater ecosystems, coastal and high seas, has a myriad of different challenges. One of them being the logistical one and the political one, and the fact that we don't have standards. And now we're including OECMs, other effective area-based conservation measures. Again, there are a set of standards. How well they're implemented can be very variable. If they use the UNESCO standard, it will probably include rubber plantations, because that's certainly what we see in Asia. In rivers, which are highly fragmented, measuring the protected is very challenging and, of course, gives you no assurance of quality. If you've got pollution upstream, even if you protect a stretch of river, you're not going to actually maintain biodiversity. And until the High Seas Treaty, which still has not been ratified, though it now has agreement of over 70 countries, that provides us with the framework to start trying to do something in the high seas. But it was very interesting that that made it into being a target because, yeah, the high seas are crucial for conservation. Many species depend on it. But the CBD doesn't apply to areas beyond national jurisdiction. And so now we are hopefully going to get legislation that provides funding and mechanisms to allow that to be realized. But under its initial version, it was no way that it was enforceable because it's outside the remits of the agreement and there is no actual architectural framework to be able to institute anything in that region. So it's a very interesting target, but it needs a lot of work to be able to make it meaningful and make it realizable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of wiggle room for countries. You know, on the one hand, countries need guidance or may need guidance because, you know, they might lack capacities or internal capacity. So this is something that they need just to have something to aim at. On the other hand, you'll also get countries which are quite happy to not have very specific guidance so that they can, you know, wiggle their way in whatever direction they want. Yeah.
And we have countries that will just be like, let's protect all the areas where there aren't people and then we can reach this target.
Right. Actually, that does unintentionally, but that does bring me to the next question, which was, do you think that it makes sense to have the amount of focus that we have on governments, considering all these shortcomings and also considering the fact that the predecessor to the GBF has been, unfortunately, almost entirely unsuccessful? Of course, these UN bodies are designed to speak to government, so they can't just change their remit all of a sudden. But they could potentially focus within them. You know, they could focus attention on governments engaging more with the private sector, for example, encouraging governments to engage more with the private sector, for example. Perhaps they could also, at the sort of intergovernmental organization level, have more interactions with other intergovernmental organizations that deal with the private sector. I don't know. I haven't really thought about this very much, but there are probably other ways of doing it. But I guess the question is, what do you think about the focus on governments? Do you think it's a case of just honing that, or are we just barking up the wrong tree to start off with?
So there are three things that makes me think of. One is, so actually linking back to your last question and the lack of success of Aichi, under the changed definition of Aichi to include OECM, some people say that Target 15 was successful, which again comes back to why definitions are very important and also to some example how it could water it down. And within both Target 3 of the Kunming to Montreal GBF and the Aichi targets, that change to include OECMs fundamentally changes the degree of protection that may be afforded to these regions. And again, those strict definitions are crucial. The other two things that makes me think about is, so before Kunming / Montreal, we had the meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, and there was the Sharm el-Sheikh to Kunming action agenda, where we had pledges from multiple organizations that included many non-governmental actors. So that was one thing that was much more inclusive than most of the frameworks, but has been quite effective in many instances and did bring in businesses, organizations, communities who were able to make pledges. I encourage the listeners to go and look at that. There is a webpage that shows the pledges and what they are on. It does provide something actionable, quantifiable, and engaging. Something else we saw within the Montreal discussions is that both the business and the finance communities had their own forums, and something that they were calling on from the CBD was to have an ambitious framework, because it was something that they could then take back to their stakeholders and say, look, we have this mandate to work under. And as we were talking about earlier with Target 19 and just how complex it is, some of this is because of the financial dimension and the business dimension, trying to bring them in because they are part of that. And now we have things like the Task Force for Nature-Based Disclosures. And so there are elements that are trying to bring them in, but the amount of power, et cetera, they have is still very variable. And so I think more specific elements that work with them and give them the ability to finesse these targets could make things more effective. And there are certainly members of those communities that are trying to do a whole lot better. But again, we need partnerships. An interesting example of this, so now Europe is meant to be deforestation free for certain commodities based on certain things. So there are lots of loopholes, but at least it's a step forward. At least it is making use of tools like trades and Starling verification so we can start having deforestation free supply chains. All of these require the interaction between businesses and governments. And so having those discussions to make sure these targets are achievable and the governments are going to be scared of damaging the economy. If they can work more with business advisors to be like, actually, there are solutions here. They may be able to agree on targets that are ambitious but realizable rather than erring on the side of caution. And so I think there is a real space for more agreements and more planning. So again, we can get targets right. Many parts of the business community are now on board, but ultimately they have to go back to their stakeholders. And so we need to find ways that empowers them to do better in ways that are more sustainable. And that will often require government support. Also, the degree of stability is another question. Governments change. And so trying to find ways that provide a long-term stable framework. Part of this will involve things like looking at the import markets for many commodities. So if the import markets start having standards and certification and import requirements, it will force the producers to comply with them. And so then you can drive economically viable, sustainable product production. Now, this is crucial for many of these targets to be successful. Supply chains is only briefly noted within the latest versions of the GBF. But it's critical because you can only have things like sustainable agriculture if you have markets for it, if it's actually financially viable. And so we need to have many more of these interactions at all levels, governments to businesses to communities. All those stakeholders need to have an engagement if these targets are to be effective in the longer term. And I think we need to learn from the process so that we can do better on successes, because I think, again, we missed opportunities. And I went to the finance and I went to the business forums just to try to better understand what was going on in that space. And I was actually impressed by some of the endeavors they were taking and the fact that they do have these major pledges that are trying to do a whole lot better. But they need support as well and standard generation, etc. And so we do need to have a whole lot more partnerships to provide better, more meaningful standards, but also to empower them so that they are able to use them. And that also means changing things like incentive structures, even things like taxes, et cetera. There are many things governments can do to encourage this. And so having more partnerships and discussion can make a real difference.
In the Frontiers paper, you briefly talk about the need for incremental progress towards the 2050 vision. And this was just one statement in the paper, so I'm not sure, maybe I'm reading too much into it. But I was curious whether you think that incremental progress is an important concept, in contrast perhaps with its sometimes what's regarded as its opposite of transformative change, which you hear a lot about these days. Was that just a mention, or was there a lot behind that remark that you made in the paper?
I think the problem with transformative progress is, think about it in terms of human behavior. Like, when we decide we're going to go on our health binge, and most of these things don't last. Like, you can have transformations, but they require a huge amount of work to make them sustainable in the longer term. Incremental progress is stepwise, but it's also much less likely to relapse. And so I think that we have to do a whole lot of things, and they have to be mainstreamed across society, but we need to make sure that they are sustainable. We're not going to get everyone turning around tomorrow and becoming vegetarian, but we can have people cutting down on meat or thinking more about where their food is coming from. Those are smaller steps that lead towards something bigger, and they can be sustained. And so I think, rather than trying to say we're going to change everything overnight, we need to do many little things that are likely to actually sum up to something larger, but are less likely to be a temporary blip before we relapse back into what we do before. And I mean, we know from societies, if we look at even things like UN conventions, the only protocol that's been truly effective is the Montreal Protocol. And that was primarily because of basically existential risk and financial risk to the US. So they acted on it. But it was also a relatively simple problem. It required a technological fix, basically, and some relatively simple targets. Biodiversity is a wicked problem. It requires us to have fundamental changes across every major sector and for us to re-examine our relationship with the natural world. That is not simple. It requires a lot of different brushstrokes. Some of them will be effective and some of them will not. And so having a multi-pronged approach where we try to address this from many different directions is likely to be how we're going to be effective in the longer term. But we cannot expect societies to say, this is a priority, let's change everything. We need to have financially viable solutions that acknowledge the challenges people face and are sustainable in the longer term. We also need those actions to be taken at all levels and all parts of society, from individuals to businesses to governments, because that is what it will take for us to even start moving towards most of these targets.
I cannot yet announce the topic or guest for next month's episode, but in 2 months' time, I'll be addressing the controversial subject of de-extinction, the idea of bringing back extinct species through advances in gene editing technology. My guest will be Virginia Matzek from the University of Santa Clara in California, and the main thing I'd like to find out from her is whether she thinks de-extinction is a good idea. But there are lots of interesting questions to ask within and around that. So I think you'll find it a fascinating chat if you're able to join us.